Under Pressure, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Sexual assault and harassment are big problems within the humanitarian aid community. But some women who've tried to report an assault have faced pressure to stay quiet.
They were told by their higher-ups, you know, this could close down our whole project. You've got to be a team player. You know, put this behind you.
Also, an employer hires an undocumented worker, but after a pay dispute, he threatens the worker with deportation.
I don't have any empathy for the guy. I hope he gets caught.
We hear why that's a growing trend in California. Plus, a young woman remembers leaving Afghanistan as a refugee and ending up in Denmark.
Suddenly, there was no war, and you could be a kid. Like, it was so normal.
Now she's a soccer pro. All that and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Thanks for being with us today. There have been a flurry of stories lately about sexual misconduct in the international aid community. Oxfam workers paying for sex in Haiti. UN peacekeepers assaulting the people they're supposed to be helping in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Truly disturbing stories, but not new ones. What's new is that the issue is finally getting attention. And for the next 3 days, The World will be looking at another aspect of sexual misconduct in the aid sector, harassment of humanitarian workers themselves. Here's veteran aid worker Heidi Lehman.
I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find a female aid or development worker who has not experienced some type of sexual harassment. And I think, unfortunately, navigating sexual harassment and finding ways to keep yourself safe as a woman is often seen as the price of being a female aid worker. That's wrong.
We'll be hearing more from Lehman in the days ahead. Amy Costello has been investigating the issue of sexual abuse in the aid sector. She's the new senior correspondent and investigations editor for Nonprofit Quarterly. And we're partnering with NPQ as part of our Across Women's Lives project. Amy sat down with my colleague Marco Werman to talk about her reporting.
Amy, we've been hearing so much lately about sexual misconduct in the ranks of NGOs and the United Nations, exploiting the populations that they serve. But you've been looking into assault and harassment by aid workers against their own colleagues, right?
That's right. I've been working with producer Freddie Boswell, and we've been spending the last few months speaking to women aid workers about the dangers they face on the job. And, you know, usually I think we think of roadside bombs and natural disasters, and those are the kinds of risks that women expect to face in this kind of work. And they're often trained on how to handle those kinds of crises, but they don't expect to face this kind of level of harassment in their work. And I want to share the story of one aid worker, Megan Nobert. She was working in South Sudan in 2015 at a camp for internally displaced people. And she was focused on helping women and girls there to cope with sexual violence and how it could be prevented. And she told me she felt prepared for the threats that she would face working in a conflict zone like that. And here's her story.
I don't think that I could be, you know, conceived as being naive. And certainly, you know, while I understood, you know, the risks of being in South Sudan and there were bombings, you know, it was a calculated risk, me being there. I certainly never expected that somebody would put drugs in my red wine on a Saturday night.
After Nobert drank that doctored wine, she says she was raped, not by a soldier, not by a random stranger, but by one of her colleagues, a man working as a contractor for UNICEF. A few months later, Nobert decided to go public with her story and began speaking to the press.
Immediately after the articles went public, I was contacted by so many different survivors within the humanitarian community saying, "This happened to me."
So Nobert founded the group Report the Abuse in 2015, which she describes as the only global nonprofit working on the issue of sexual violence against aid workers. It folded 2 years later due to a lack of funding, but Nobert says she heard from more than 1,000 aid workers about their experiences with sexual abuse and harassment. Most of them told her they had experienced it in the course of their work. About 65% of those incidents were perpetrated by their colleagues. Now, Nobert's survey is not scientific. She knows it's a self-selected group that responded. Even so, other surveys reveal that abuse and harassment in the aid sector is a problem. And yet, many aid groups don't train their staff about these risks. After Nobert was raped, she discovered the aid group she was working for was caught off guard by what had happened to her. And she suffered even more as a result.
They had no policies or procedures in place to address sexual violence. And insofar as I'm aware, nobody within the organization, or at least within senior management, knew how to respond to a sexual violence survivor. So they did their best in many ways. They did eventually evacuate me. It took about a week, which was a long time considering I was being almost hourly at one point exposed to my perpetrator as he followed me around the camp in Bentiu. They wouldn't take the time to emergency extract me because that was effort on their part. And if I wanted to get out, that was on me. And I was in such a state of shock and trauma that I couldn't figure out how to find the right person to get the form filled out to get extracted early. So I was there for a week while my perpetrator followed me around begging me to not tell anybody what happened.
Hmm. Did you press charges against the perpetrator?
No. So unfortunately, South Sudan, and there's a reason that we're there, it's a very weak state. So the police force and the justice system are non-functioning. And in fact, in the course of my work, working on sexual violence in the local population, I would never recommend a woman go to the justice system because it would be so re-traumatizing that I don't think it would end up serving good in the end. Do no harm is a strong principle in humanitarian action. So for myself, going to the local police, that wasn't really an option. I did try to get some sort of accountability or action through UNICEF because he was working for a contractor of UNICEF. And unfortunately, that particular relationship falls within a gray area. So UNICEF has no responsibility for the actions of their contractors, even if it is committing something as horrendous as rape.
UNICEF says it did tell the contractor to remove the perpetrator from any UNICEF assignments. But that man who assaulted Nobert could be following another woman around right now in some other conflict zone. Maybe he assaulted other women before he arrived in South Sudan. It's hard to know. We spoke to this humanitarian worker who wanted us to protect her identity and her voice as she's still working in the sector. She says when she's thinking of hiring someone, it's almost impossible to vet them properly because the nature of aid work is so global and so transitory. Trying to track down the reputation of one person sounds a little like global espionage.
If you don't know anyone who has been in the same organization, in the same mission, in the same country, in the same period of time, then many, many times you just have no way to really check. People change organizations, everybody moves, so it's really hard to track.
So that's one humanitarian aid worker who's anonymous by request. Amy Costello back in the studio with me. If we're comparing humanitarian aid workers and their harassment to what's happening in other fields, I mean, it's certainly shocking, it's unexpected, but is it worse? What's your sense?
Well, I mean, that's part of the problem, is that there's really a lack of data. And part of the reason is that the sector really hasn't been set up to encourage victims to come forward. So like many issues around violence against women, the scope of the problem is likely underreported because victims are silenced in all kinds of ways.
People who try to report can be blocked by their supervisors. They can be blocked through intimidation and continued harassment.
That's Tufts University professor Diane Mazzarana, and she's one of the few scholars who have conducted studies about sexual harassment and abuse among aid workers specifically. And she and her colleagues looked at testimonies from 57 men and women who were victims of sexual harassment and assault, and then they did 30 in-depth interviews. And she says it's an industry in denial.
A number of times when we spoke to victims, they said that they were not believed, and when they pressed, they were fired. Their contracts were terminated. They were transferred without notice. So just getting rid of them, getting rid of the problem is what we see. That somehow the victim is the problem because they're bringing up the fact that there's something really wrong with the agency, and the agencies don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, but Amy, now they have to. I mean, as we just heard in that story and as we've been hearing, this has become a major problem.
It has. And, it absolutely remains to be seen what actually will be done. But there are certainly growing calls for major reform. Even in recent weeks, over 1,000 aid workers and counting have signed an open letter calling for urgent reform in the aid sector. And agencies claim that they are improving things like reporting processes, staff training, instituting zero tolerance policies. And we'll hear more about those initiatives later in the series.
It strikes me, though, that this can get really tricky, right? This isn't like the entertainment industry where there are profits just rolling in. I mean, aid groups rely on donors, sometimes really big donors. and lots of small donations from the public. So public image is everything here.
It really is. And because donations are so critical in the aid sector, Diane Mazzarana, the Tufts professor, told me that fears about donors can put victims who come forward in a very tough position.
A number of the women that we spoke with and a number of the LGBTQ community that we spoke with, males and females, both said that when they had experienced sexual assault, they were told by their higher-ups, you know, this could close down our whole project. You're putting the whole project at risk. If you report and the media gets news of this, you know, we're done. You got to be a team player. You got to, you know, put this behind you.
And especially disturbing because, as I said earlier, humanitarian aid workers, we have this assumption that they are good people helping out people in need. They treat women with respect.
Right. And, you know, that's probably largely true. But there is another factor here. I spoke to a veteran aid worker named Heather, who still works in the sector, and she only wanted us to use her first name for that reason. She's worked on emergency humanitarian response in 16 nations on issues of violence against women and girls. And she says that while working in dangerous places may appeal to lots of good-hearted folks, it does appeal to other kinds of people, too.
It's not a surprise, or it shouldn't be a surprise to us, that humanitarian aid is an environment that perpetrators actively seek to work in. Because, first of all, they have enormous access to very vulnerable people and huge opportunity in environments where there is so little oversight. And at the same time, they have the cover and the guise of doing good in the world. And being a bit brave and being a bit committed to something that for a lot of people not in the sector seems dangerous and extraordinary.
We should remember, too, that the people who do the kind of work that we're talking about, this aid work, it's hard work. It's tough. You're in the midst of crisis, in the middle of famine, sometimes war. Does the type of work that these workers are doing every day in crisis zones, how much does that have an impact on whether they're reporting harassment or not?
Obviously, such a big sector, so hard to generalize, but I think it is worth considering, and people that I talked to said that women who work in humanitarian aid specifically may be inclined to put issues of harassment on the back burner because they are indeed working with people in crisis, and so they may see their own harassment or abuse as kind of insignificant in comparison. And here's Heather again.
There is quite a lot of chaotic stuff going on quite often, and so if something happens in an environment that is very unstable, who are you going to report it to outside your organisation? And I think that those kinds of environments can be very adrenaline-fueled and can be very heightened in the sense of what beneficiaries need, what the people we're working with need, and that that's the priority above everything else. And so it becomes very easy for there to be a kind of stop whinging about this minor thing when out here people are dying.
So there's some serious layers in this whole discussion of sexual harassment in the world of humanitarian aid, Amy. Tell us what's coming up in the next few days.
Well, we're going to look at who increasingly is doing humanitarian aid work across the globe. And it's many people of color from developing nations. And we're going to hear from a veteran aid worker from Eastern Horn of Africa who describes the harassment and abuse that she's endured in almost every nation she's worked in.
I think it's a big problem in the humanitarian industry, not only for white women, but for black women.
Amy Costello will be bringing us more voices from the international aid community as her series continues this week. She was speaking there with Marco Werman. And be sure to join us for a Facebook Live on Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Amy will be hosting a panel on the Me Too movement in the aid sector. You'll find that at our Across Women's Lives Facebook page. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Imagine your employer didn't give you your paycheck. Now imagine you complained about it, and your boss then threatened to have you deported. It's something that's happening more and more in California. From Los Angeles, Deepa Fernandez has the story.
On a warm winter evening in Los Angeles, I went to see a newly renovated home. It was on the market. Asking price, a cool $2 million.
I turn junk into pearls. This is what I do.
James Balsamo is the contractor who revamped this house.
So I took the bottom step, enlarged it, elongated it, made it look better so it looked like Gone with the Wind.
But the story behind this home, not so pretty. Balsamo is one of thousands of employers in Southern California accused of stealing their workers' paychecks. He hired a worker to tile a bathroom for $900. Balsamo said the worker did a terrible job and said, redo it. The worker said, first pay me for the days I already worked. Balsamo refused.
Why didn't you just pay him the daily?
He didn't finish the job.
But the agreement was that you would pay him by day. Why not just pay him?
He agreed to do the job in 3 days for the bathroom alone for $900.
But the law says you have to pay him. So you didn't like the work.
I gave him the job to do the bathroom. That's what it was set for. $900, you finish the bathroom, you get $900.
The worker said he'd sue, and Balsamo says threatened him too. So Balsamo texted him that he was going to call the police. This all happens in the small Southern California city of Arcadia.
I'm going to call Arcadia PD on you, and because now that I know you're illegal, you don't have a green card, and if you get detained by ICE, I don't want that to happen. Just finish your work, dude. Just get your stuff done.
What's on record is that you threatened to put him in handcuffs.
No.
But that's what court records say Balsamo texted. Now, the California Labor Commissioner, Julie Su, has fined him $100,000, accusing him of retaliation. Here's Su.
We're seeing just a growing, not just retaliation against immigrant workers, but an emboldening of employers who are making these kinds of threats blatantly.
Balsamo is one of four cases Su's office has filed since August against employers who have allegedly threatened employees with deportation.
Increasingly, employers are so emboldened that we've had employers call my office to say, do you know that this worker who filed a complaint is illegally in the country? And if you pursue me, I'm going to have ICE come and get her.
While it's illegal to hire undocumented workers, many people still do. These workers also contribute $180 billion annually to the California economy. And under state law, an employer must pay any laborer for their work, regardless of their immigration status. Attorney Sebastian Sanchez helps workers file claims with the state for unpaid wages and, increasingly, immigration retaliation.
We've seen retaliation claims based on, you know, just firing workers. But bringing up immigration status is something that was not happening in the recent past.
Advocates say that these threats keep workers from telling their stories to law enforcement. On the outskirts of Los Angeles, we meet a ranch hand who says he earned $90 for working a 14-hour day.
Cuando llegábamos, luego íbamos a donde estaba la comida de los animales, la alfalfa.
He says his job involved feeding the horses, hauling big bales of hay, among other manual work. He worked for 2 months, but didn't get paid for all of it, he says. So he filed a claim for back wages. Then he received this threatening text message.
Que decía que ilegales como yo no deberían de estar en este país, sino que deberían de regresar y que muy pronto migración me...
The text said illegals like me shouldn't be in the country and should return, and that soon immigration would visit me. He thinks his boss sent the text.
Para mí... dije un poco de miedo, quizás no por mí tanto, sino por...
He says he felt afraid when the text arrived. Not really for myself, but for my family, he says. I didn't want them to have problems because of me, so I decided to leave that place. We reached out to his boss, who in an email strongly denied these claims, but declined to be interviewed. Attorney Sanchez says he's seen many cases like this.
I have another case where the employer also texted the worker and said, hey, how would you like for ICE to find out that you're here? It's almost like the employers know these are the key words they throw out right now. There's a climate of fear. Let's take advantage of it.
Back in the LA suburb of Arcadia, James Balsamo, the employer we heard from at the start of the story, he says he isn't moved by the plight of workers like the one he admitted not paying and who is now costing him thousands of dollars in fines from the labor board.
I don't have any empathy for the guy. I hope he gets caught. I really do at this point.
For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Los Angeles.
Deepa's story was first reported for KCET's SoCal Connected. We have a link to that television report at PRI.org. Our partners at the BBC land a lot of great interviews. This one's about Chile's Oscar-winning film, A Fantastic Woman, about a transgender singer who faces discrimination after her boyfriend's death. The movie stars Daniela Vega, a transgender woman with no prior acting experience. The Oscar victory sparked celebrations in Chile, but also debate about the real-life discrimination faced by transgender Chileans in the conservative nation. My BBC colleague Jane Chambers spoke with Daniela Vega in Santiago, and here's the bit I want to play for you, where Vega explains how music helped shape her life.
Yes, music plays a big part in my life. I started to have music lessons when I was very young. I was always surrounded by violins and guitars, the piano and singers.
And British pops also played a big part in your life and identity.
Bueno, sí, David Bowie fue muy importante para mí en un momento.
Yes, David Bowie was very important for me at one stage.
Y también, por ejemplo, Grace Jones. O, por ejemplo, también The Cure. Entonces hay una especie como de...
Their music helped me to define my identity. I copied a lot of how they were dressing to arrive at my own look.
Because what did they teach you? That you can play with your identity?
Yo sentí a través de...
I felt that through their music and style, I could start my own transition supported by them. When I was younger, I had to find a way to explain to my parents I wasn't crazy. So I showed them the example of these pop groups, and it was part of my strategy to explain to my parents what I was going through and that I wanted to change gender. I was 13 years old when I decided to tell them that I wanted to change gender. At first, they questioned what I was telling them. They thought I was gay. And they told me they were going to go to the beach so they could think it through. When they came back, they brought me a present. It was a makeup box. And that made me feel so much love for them.
Amor. Sentí que ellos
it made me realize how much they loved me. At 14 years old, I started my change. And remember, this was 14 years ago when things were very different. And they supported me and said, yes, let's make this work.
Chile's Daniela Vega there. She was speaking with the BBC's Jane Chambers in Santiago. I'm Carol Hills. A former Russian spy is attacked with a nerve agent on British soil. The UK blames Russia and kicks out 23 Russian diplomats. But does the Kremlin care?
There's a saying on this side of the Atlantic, you may have it too, that you should be cautious about wrestling with a pig because you just get dirty and the pig enjoys it.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 23 Russian diplomats left Britain today. They were expelled by the British government in response to the poisoning on March 4th of former Russian agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. The Skripals are still fighting for their lives. Three policemen were also affected by the nerve agent, one seriously. It was the first use of chemical weapons in Europe since the 1940s. There are calls in the UK for a much stronger response. Writer Oliver Bullough joins me now from London. Oliver, how would you hit back at Russia?
Well, obviously there is an established procedure in international and diplomatic disputes. You expel each other's diplomats, you close their cultural agencies, you generally insult them on via the media. All of those things have been followed. All of those things have been followed in the past. I don't think, to be honest, that they're likely to make very much difference. There's a saying on this side of the Atlantic, you may have it too, that you should be cautious about wrestling with a pig because you just get dirty and the pig enjoys it. And I think that might be relevant in this case. The Russians are far more accomplished at this kind of game than the British are. So I personally would like to see a focus on trying to go after the business interests of members of the Kremlin elite, particularly since that would allow the British government to in a way, talk over their heads to the Russian nation and be able to point out that these measures are not intended to punish Russia as a whole, but merely intended to punish the insiders, the political class that take the kind of decisions that result in incidents like this.
And does Britain or Theresa May have the power to do that, to take the steps you recommend?
Well, obviously, such steps would be more potent if they could be taken together with other Western powers, obviously, in particular the United States, but also the European countries. But Britain is a significant financial center, so obviously has a degree of political and financial weight in that department. And also, not irrelevantly, London in particular and the southeast of England more generally have long been the favored playground of the Russian elite, the wealthy post-Soviet Russian classes. They like to spend their money here. They like to buy property here. They like to send their children to school and to university here. They like to retire here if they fall out with Vladimir Putin. So in that regard, actually, Britain does have much more leverage than any other equivalent European country would in this particular kind of environment. And so, yes, I think that there are steps that could be taken on which, personally, I would like the government to be considering more carefully.
But by hurting the Kremlin's elites financially, does that, by extension, risk hurting Britain?
Of course it does, because we've become a butler to the global elite as a country. You know, selling property, luxury goods, education to the children of the global elite is a real growth industry. And of course, it isn't just the Russians that would be scared away were Britain to get tough. There are a lot of people whose fortunes are of questionable origin who might look at this and say, well, if they're going to go for the Russians, you know, who next? But I suppose, certainly from my perspective, the calculation has to be, if you don't stand up to the first use of chemical weapons in Europe since World War II, you know, what do you stand up to? If Britain sort of rolls over and just takes this, then really we'd be a playground not just for oligarchs, but also for the security services of the whole world. So I think this is the time when a line has to be drawn, really, and firm action taken, because otherwise, you've sort of essentially become a bit of a laughingstock.
Oliver Bullough, what keeps you focused on this topic? You've been on this issue of Russian elite in England for a while. Why does it preoccupy you so much?
Yeah, it's not just Russian money, and to be honest, I'm a Russianist, so I began in Russia. But actually, as I've sort of looked at this more and more, I've realized that the problem of the, as it were, theft of natural resources from poor countries and the spending of that money in rich countries is one of the great ongoing crimes of our age, if not the great ongoing crime. It drives all sorts of nasty behavior, from sort of terrorism to authoritarianism. So I lived in Russia for a long time. I'm very fond of the country. I loved living there. And increasingly, I came to the conclusion that most of the sort of negative tendencies that I saw there, that I wrote about in previous books, I wrote about in many articles, were largely the consequence of essentially industrial corruption. And that industrial corruption is enabled by the willingness of cities like London, above all London, but not just London, to accept no questions asked dirty money without asking at what cost that money was acquired. I live in London, very fond of this city. And I think that it's a great shame that so much of our prosperity is based on other people's misery.
Oliver Bullough is author of two books on Russia. Oliver, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Politics and dirty money are at the heart of our next story as well. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy was taken into police custody for questioning today. Sarkozy is facing allegations that the late Libyan dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, secretly gave him 50 million euros during the 2007 French presidential campaign. Yep, hardly chump change. And here's the thing, foreign campaign contributions of any amount aren't allowed in French campaigns. Time correspondent Vivian Walt joins us from Paris. Vivian, this investigation has been going on for a few years. What are the actual allegations against Nicolas Sarkozy?
Well, the allegations have been swirling around for several years, really since the Libyan Revolution, which was exactly 7 years ago, almost to the day. And if you remember, Sarkozy was the one that actually ordered the bombing of Libya in 2011. Right after that, actual information emerged that Libya and, in fact, Gaddafi had helped him in his 2007 presidential campaign by funding him in cash to the tune of about $82 million.
And what is the evidence of this?
Well, the evidence has kind of filtered out in dribs and drabs. The reason why it's coming to a head right now is that there have been a couple of key arrests in the last couple of months by people who claim to have been the go-betweens between Gaddafi and the former president. Sarkozy has dismissed all the accusations against him. He's called them grotesque. And he also seems to suggest that there has been some kind of political witch hunt against him by his political enemies.
What's interesting is that Sarkozy's relationship with Gaddafi wasn't all negative. Take us back to 2007 when Sarkozy was running for the presidency.
You know, it's hard to believe right now, but in 2007, leaders, especially from Europe, were really elbowing each other out the way in order to get to Gaddafi and sign big deals with Libya. The sanctions had been lifted. Libya, being a really major oil nation, was signing very big deals, including with Total, the French oil company. And particularly, President Sarkozy was very keen to sell his French fighter jets, the Rafale, to Gaddafi. So there were a lot of reasons for Sarkozy to be on good terms with Gaddafi in Libya.
Muammar Gaddafi actually visited France, didn't he?
He did indeed. He visited France. He had meetings with President Sarkozy. There are a number of, you know, pictures of them very warmly greeting each other. But this was not unusual. I mean, I recall myself being in Libya in the years before the Arab Spring and seeing Prime Minister Berlusconi there and Gerhard Schroeder, all sorts of European leaders. It really was not that unusual for that period of time.
You spoke to one of Gaddafi's sons, Saif al-Islam, about Sarkozy. What did he tell you?
You know, I had interviewed Saif three times for Time magazine over the years. My last interview with Saif Gaddafi was basically 1 week before the bombing strikes. And he effectively said that he had documents that proved that Sarkozy had taken campaign funding from his father and that he was waiting for a good moment to expose these documents and to embarrass Sarkozy.
How is the French public responding to these allegations and the fact that this investigation seems to be stepping up a bit?
I think that people are beginning to believe that there really is something to this. For a long time, they didn't. These accusations and documents have been filtering out for about 5 years now. And I think for a long time, the French were very skeptical and believed that there were sort of a lot of conspiracy theories against Sarkozy. But given the fact that he has now, for the first time, been officially questioned about this affair and could in fact be prosecuted, this is sort of taking it to a whole other level. And usually when it gets to this level, the French assume that it requires some legal proof for the prosecutors to pull him in for questioning for 48 hours.
Time correspondent Vivian Walt in Paris. Thanks, Vivian.
You're welcome.
Our next story is about a remarkable soccer player, a woman who's been, cliche alert, saved by the sport of football, as the Europeans call it. Nadia Nadim was born in Herat, Afghanistan, but as my BBC colleague Irene Caselli found out in Denmark, Nadim's come a long way.
Hey, I'm Nadia Nadim, and I'm a football player. I started playing when we came to Denmark in 2000, started in a refugee camp because we had like these awesome fields beside the camp. And yeah, that's where I fell in love with the game.
An hour north of Copenhagen, you come to the Sandholm Center. It's the point of entry for most asylum seekers in Denmark. It's not what you might expect when you hear the phrase refugee camp. It's a former military headquarters in a wide, open space, surrounded by green fields. 18 years ago, Nadia Nadim spent a few weeks here in Sandholm before going on to another asylum center, where her love story with football began.
I knew what football was because my dad was so into the game, and I had that football at home, but we used to play other games with it. So that's the first time I kind of knew how to play it, because I saw other teams play it and I saw the girls' team play football, and we were like, oh, that's how it's supposed to be.
About an hour away from Sandholm, I visited another center for asylum seekers, where a charity organizes weekly indoor football classes for women and girls. Some were wearing a veil. They were Palestinian and Lebanese, and some were from Afghanistan, like Nadia. Seeing them running around and having fun, I thought about what it must have been like for Nadia during her first months in Denmark when she was only 11 years old.
Suddenly there was no war and you have a safe place to sleep and you could be a kid. Like, it was so normal that everyone was just having fun, and I felt like the game brought so much joy to all the players doing that, and we wanted to be a part of that.
What do you think would have happened to your life if you'd stayed on in Afghanistan?
If I still were alive, I probably would be married and had some kids and, I don't know, been home going. I can't even imagine, like, actually being alive, because the way my mentality is, I wouldn't just take it. So my dad was in the Afghan military, and when the Taliban gained power in the country, they killed him. And my mom's lives were in danger because of the rules and the position that women had in the country at that point. Like, you weren't really allowed to work, go to school, just be a human being, you know. Even just going out for a walk or getting milk, you had to be with a man. And because we're five sisters and my mom, that was kind of hard. So my mom made the decision that we had to leave the country, and then, yeah, paid some human smuggler tons of money to get us out, and we drove to Pakistan, and then with fake passports, we flew to Italy, and then from there, with a truck, we ended up in Denmark. So I'm lucky that I got out, and I got a second chance.
Nadia certainly made the most of her second chance. She was the first nationalized Dane ever to join the country's national women's football team. And she has just joined Manchester City in England. But despite the fame and the recognition she has received, she's very down to earth. A few months after our first meeting, I caught up with Nadia in Denmark. The football season was over and she was fully immersed in her other passion, medicine.
I love playing the game, but I wanted to do a bigger difference in life because I think I have the capacity of being able to, like, help other people. And I think being in a position as a doctor, I might affect more people's lives than I'm doing as a football player.
Nadia trains several hours every day, and even during the peak football season, she carries her medical books with her everywhere she goes.
Yeah, my days are really packed. There's not a lot of time, but it's exciting to be here, and I'm happy I have the opportunity to do both, you know? And sometimes it does demand sacrifices, and this is one of them. Like, it's hard on you. But I feel if you really want something, you need to sometimes give up some stuff to achieve some, and I'm doing it.
Soccer star Nadia Nadim ending that report by Irene Caselli for the BBC's Outlook program. Spare a thought today for Sudan. Not the country, but Sudan the rhino. He was the last male northern white rhino on the planet, and he died today at a nature reserve in Kenya. He was 45 or about 90 in human years. The cause of death was basically old age. But Sudan had a heck of a life. As poachers killed off rhinos across Africa in the 70s and 80s, Sudan was rescued and taken to a zoo in the Czech Republic. In 2009, in an attempt to encourage breeding, Sudan, along with two females and one other male, were brought to Kenya's Opeheta Conservancy. The idea was to encourage the rhinos to mate. Unfortunately, none of the attempts were successful. The other male northern white rhino died in 2014. The two females are now the only members of the subspecies left. The Conservancy did try to raise Sudan's profile last year. They put him on the dating app Tinder, as we heard from Richard Vine back in April.
You know, he's a big animal. He's now pretty aged, slightly cantankerous occasionally. He's a very impressive animal, as all of these rhinos are.
Vine runs the Old Paheta Conservancy. He told us they put Sudan on Tinder to help raise awareness of and money for rhino IVF efforts. But there was a larger message, too.
Sudan has become sort of emblematic of the plight that is facing many thousands of species across the planet. If we can use him as a kind of celebrity, for want of a better word, to raise people's awareness about the impact that we humans are having on the planet, that would be something that is worthwhile doing.
Today, after Sudan's death, Fine said the Conservancy remained committed to trying to save the subspecies. They even collected some of Sudan's genetic material in the hopes that he still might produce offspring. Fine estimated that each in vitro fertilization effort to save the northern white rhino will cost between $9 and $10 million. Yep, not cheap. But Fine's getting online help from some celebrities who are tweeting about Sudan using the hashtag #WeDidThis. On behalf of all mankind, wrote one, I'm sorry. Finally today, a musician tries to find just the right mix of Thai, Swedish, and American culture. My colleague Rupa Shenoy of the World's Otherhood podcast explains.
There's an informal term for folks raised in multiple places and multiple cultures. They're called third culture kids. And it can be a struggle for those kids to understand their identity. They often feel like they don't fit in anywhere. That's what Sirintip Fasuk was trying to express on her debut album. Sirintip was born and raised in Thailand. Her dad's Thai. She lived there until she was 11 years old. Then she moved to Stockholm, Sweden, where her mom was from.
Being in Thailand, I kind of felt like an outsider because my mom was much taller and much bigger than all the other kids' parents because she was Swedish. And then, you know, if we had birthday parties, we had all these other weird games that none of the other kids had ever played before. And as much as I thought that that was fun, it was also, you know, scary because as a kid, you just want to fit in. And then when I moved to Sweden, it was the opposite of like, oh, here comes this Thai girl who has all these weird Thai games. I guess because I have that experience of always kind of like not fitting in 100%.
Sirintip didn't understand how she felt about being a mix of cultures until she became a young adult. She moved away from her family to New York, and it was living there where she felt free to be whatever she wanted to be. The album was written in that spirit.
The title is Tribus. I think in Latin you would say tribus, but I think tribus sounds more contemporary. And it means three in Latin. And the reason why I chose that title is because of the three cultures that I come from, the three languages, three continents. Also, with the picture on the album cover, I have the three masks. I read something about how in Japan you have the outer layer of a mask is the one that you show the world. The second one is the one you show for friends. And the third one is the one you show for your family and your closest people. And I chose not to just have two masks and then my face, because I think that there's also one layer underneath all of that, which is the core of who you are.
There's a strong tone in the music of pushing back, of frustration. Sirintip wanted to express how tired she was with people trying to categorize her, people who expected her to follow one particular culture. This is how I'm thinking.
I think like everyone deals with that difficulty, you know, of like deciding which direction to go with your life and how, and then like not listening too much to, you know, the outside world and all the things that you're expected to do. Gonna do this, gonna do that, and then gonna be it, gotta be everything.
Back. Sirintip wanted this album to be a sort of virtual space for third culture kids, something they could claim as their own, something that could inspire them to accept their individuality.
I think it's important to cherish that kind of difference that we have as individuals who have not, you know, grown up in just one place and not be scared of the differences that makes us the way we are.
Third culture kids might be an undefinable mix of their own global culture, Sirintip says, each on their own unpredictable path. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
For more on Third Culture Kids, check out Rupa's Otherhood podcast. Just look for the episode about former President Barack Obama, a Third Culture Kid himself. Otherhood's on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast listening app you use. And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.